I'm sure we can all remember a day back in our school days when the teacher left the classroom for a moment and all forms of misadventure began, an unraveling of the rules of the classroom. Things were thrown, bullies erupted, the noise levels rose, and if it was a smart class, you had a spy at the door that was, you know, waiting, she's coming, and everybody would be back in their seats looking very angelic-like with, you know, the floor a complete disaster. If you didn't, then perhaps if you didn't time it right and the teacher walked into the room in the middle of it, or even worse, the principal, and that in the middle of that monkey business, there was a sense of doom that enveloped the room. And this ominous feeling and collective sweep of detention terror went through the room. And I wonder if that's a little bit like how Job was feeling as God shows up, finally. We read over the last few weeks Job's story. And finally, as we read this morning, God comes to Job in the wind. A terrifying, destructive wind, one that could even be translated as tornado, proving once again that sometimes God is present even in the most terrifying events. And perhaps God will come to us in ways that we don't expect or in places that we don't think of God coming. In fact, if you read back further in the Old Testament, Moses also found God in an incredible storm. The disciples experienced Jesus working a miracle when he calmed the storm. So sometimes, even though we sing, "Be still my soul," and we encourage people to go on retreats and to find quiet time with God, those are our phrases, perhaps we also need to be storm chasers. You might have seen them on the news most recently with the storms that were coming on from the U.S. They were the ones standing with a microphone looking like they were going to be blown into the ocean any second. And you kind of wondered, who are those crazy people? Storm chasers. And maybe as Christian people, if we're looking for God, we need to go find storms. And there is a terrifying beauty to the words that God is offering. And there's also a challenge because God offers no explanation. But this poetic description of God's beauty and creative curator and caretaker of the world. All the images that I read this week made me wish that I could paint, because they were just so beautiful. I'm going to read a few verses that we didn't read this morning. Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness? When I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place? When I said to the sea, "This far you may come and no farther. Here is where your proud waves halt. Have you ever given order to the morning or shown the dawn its place, that it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of it? The earth takes shape like clay under a seal. Its features stand out like those of a garment." And I could take each one of those words and make a sermon out of it. The earth takes shape like clay under a seal. The seal was that which the potter put on his clay when it was finished, so that the world and the shipping and the market would know that that was the his or her handiwork. And God, in the same way, places his seal on his handiwork. And we are in a season that feels like all over the place, God is just erupting in beauty and in the coolness of the air and in color. And this is what God was pointing out to Job. And in planning this sermon, I went to look in the concordance in the back that lists all the songs that correspond with the books of the Bible. And I realized in that moment that there isn't a single song dedicated to Job. Not one. Not one song that I could find that mentions Job. I found a couple of choruses, and because I'm a hallelujah hopper and I kind of move between different denominations, I have hymnals for all the mainline denominations. And I checked their books, and they had hymns that were kind of connected with Job, but not one that actually said his name. And yet, Job's experience is probably one of the most people identify with. Job lost everything. He lost his wealth, his children, his servants, his livestock, and his health. And if that wasn't bad enough, his friends and his wife provided the worst kinds of responses and were utter failures at providing meaningful support. And if you remember our reading from last week, Job desired to speak with God, to plead his case, and essentially to set God straight on what was completely wrong with his situation. I remember one woman in my practice who lost a child defiantly saying, "When I get to heaven and meet God, boy, have I got some things to argue with him." And I thought, okay, but better read the book of Job before you try that one. Because that's exactly the place that Job was at. We are told that we are never given more than we can handle. But sometimes I think God has the wrong address. And Job's situation is a strange one. It's the result of a heavenly bet. Satan didn't believe there was one person on earth that was blameless and upright. And God says, "But look, there's my servant Job." And Satan says, "It's only because you've put a hedge around him of protection that he's that way. Take it away and he will falter." And so in Job 1:11 we read, "Strike out, but now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." And Job had the opposite reaction in chapter 1. "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not change, nor sin, nor charge God with wrong. But as we get towards chapter 37 of Job's problems and Job's trials, he's getting tired. He's getting frustrated. He wishes for understanding. He wishes for a reason. And as we go further into Job's story, it sort of reminded me of that joke, what happens when you play a country song backwards? You get your wife back, your dog back, and your truck back. And in some ways, everything was restored twice over, but it never makes up for the losses. Because if you lost a child, somebody saying to you, "Well, you've got three others," doesn't matter. But Job stood there and questioned God. And we want God to speak to us. We want God to understand. Maybe we want to understand something about our experience or our world. We have the questions of why me? Have I done something wrong? Maybe we want to understand something about the world we live in. Those headlines we read every day. Why? How could suffering be allowed? Where is God in this big circumference we call earth of a mess? And this whole chapter and beyond is not God's answers to suffering, but God's response to suffering and pain and the questions. There are no explanations, no rationalizations, or anything that would promote Job's understanding. But God God does provide a response. And as readers, we understand that this is a situation between God and Satan, that Job is the unwitting person in the middle. But in his place, he has no understanding of that. And God didn't even explain it to him. God didn't say, hey, by the way, me and Satan were up there in heaven and thought, you know, at your expense, we'd have a little fun just to see how good you do. He doesn't even offer that much of an explanation. He simply points to the world around him as being incredibly complex and made at his hand as being enough. And the more I work in healthcare, the more I've come to also understand how fearfully and wonderfully we are made. How every day our bodies fend off millions and millions of viruses and microbes and bacteria that could kill us, but don't. And also how it just takes one of the smallest things to put us into grave medical error, medical distress. But then diametrically opposite to Job's situation, James and John were in a pretty good place. And Jesus, too, provides a response. The disciples were in a good period of their ministry. Do you think that James and John stood at the foot of the cross and called up to Jesus and said, hey, can we be at your right and left-hand side? No, because Jesus was just pointing at that point to two crosses. They were excited enough to follow Jesus in his ministry and leave behind their family and their careers. They were popular. Those who heal the sick and feed the multitudes without draining the government coffers and turn water into wine and are proficient teachers that capture audiences at the temple and have crowds hanging off your every word tend to be people you want to hang around with. Jesus, at that point in his ministry, was the movie star of today. The person you wait to come down the red carpet. The person that you follow in the People magazines. The person that you think is really cool or has done some interesting things. This was Jesus at his point in his ministry. And of course, we want to be in people's lives that are cool. James and John were particularly uncouth at their request of Jesus, offending the other disciples. They even asked Jesus to say yes to their request before they even asked it. And from the time we are children, we want the biggest cookie. We want to be the first in line, to be honored for how smart we are. At least young children will admit they want the biggest and best cookie. As we get older, we get a little more sly at turning the dessert tray just the right way so the biggest piece lands closest to us. We kind of quietly take a second helping rather than being a kid going, can I have some more? Even when we are suffering from furniture disease, which is where our chest has fallen into our drawers, and we could do with a smaller piece, we still persist. And Jesus responds to his disciples. So it doesn't matter whether you're in the worst place in your life or a really good place in your life. Jesus responds, but he doesn't necessarily answer or even respond in a way that the disciples are able to grasp. He lets them know they have no idea, though, in much the same way. God responds to Job and says, you have no idea. And Job understands that towards the end. But the disciples have no vision for what the future holds, no understanding of what God's plan was. And yet, neither person, neither Job nor the disciples, were punished. They were responded to. And so where does that leave us? That leaves us in a place where we have to acknowledge that we can never know. The finiteness of our understanding and our poverty of words and language does not allow us to understand. Job had nothing to say in response to God. Standing even just in God's presence silenced his questions, his agony. And so seeking God's presence perhaps is an antidote, as long as you're not like Job, wondering where God is. Sometimes there are no answers. We as a reader to Job's story have some clues. We as a reader in James and John's adventures understand where the story is going. They did not at the time. Perhaps God will come to us a storm or a small moment, or perhaps we will continue to struggle with the silence and pain of unanswered prayers, at least for now. So whether you are in a good place with hope for the future, or the worst place in your life wondering why, my prayer for you today is that in some way, God will show up. Amen. We come to that time in our service when we are able to offer back to God some small response to what God has given to us. Call upon the ushers to take up this morning's offerings.